So, anyway, thank you very much for the invitation, Deborah. It's the first time I've been to Oxford Brookes University in any capacity, so it's really nice to be here. And not that long since I was in Oxford at the RCN conference, which was a huge success, I thought. So nice to meet everyone here. I realise you're not all from the nursing background, is that right? There's a multidisciplinary group, that's fine, I mean, I'm sure. I find most of you, looking at the signs on the doors along there, I think most of you would probably come under the panel that I was on anyway, which was dentistry, allied health professions, pharmacy, nursing and pharmacy, which was like a big thing with everything else. They couldn't decide where to put anywhere else, you know. So, I got a 2-hour slot, but I'll speak for about an hour or so, and happy to be interrupted with questions in the middle, as long as we get to the end, I suppose. But we've got time to discuss afterwards. Quite happy if people have got to go, and if people want coffee and things like that, just let me know if there's coffee available, certainly after I've talked, and we can have a less formal session. So the answer to what makes a ref paper refable is we don't know. Okay, so that's the end of the talk. It's a very difficult thing to quantify or even to qualify. And I think there's a lot of ingredients in this. So what I want to do is to, first of all, tell you a little bit about my own involvement with REF. I mean, I think one of the things is that people often don't understand the whole REF, you know, the whole process that's gone on for a long time. I joined academia in 1989 from my clinical position in the National Health Service, and we had something then called the Research Selectivity Exercise. That was the first of these exercises. Everybody in this room is far too young to be around then, which was the first of these kind of exercises run by the higher education funding councils in the four countries of the UK to get some handle on research. And it was really just about publications. I can vaguely remember it, but I submitted papers to that because I'd been publishing in clinical practice. But I've been returned from RE since 1996, which was the first of the real research assessment exercises when I was at Edinburgh. In 2001 and 2008, I led REF returns. I led the REF return at Hull in 2001. We went up a notch, which I was glad to say. That was a different scoring system in those days. And in 2008, I led the REF return at the University of Sheffield, and glad to say we just got it spot. We didn't do brilliantly, we did well, but I was able to predict spot on what we got. One of the biggest mistakes people can make with REF is overestimating, and that goes on a lot. And I was involved as an RE sub-panel member for nursing and midwifery in 2008, so I've had experience of REE, and I was also on the REF sub-panel for dentistry, allied health professions, nursing and pharmacy in 2014. There's not so much difference between REE and REF, to be absolutely honest. The processes were very, very similar. Of course, the additional thing in REF is impact, which I'm not specifically addressing today, but I'm happy to talk about as well. And of course, I didn't lead I'd gone back to Hull at this time. I didn't lead the 2014 one, but again, helped to create papers. And I was pleased to say, out of the whole university, blowing our collective trumpet in nursing and whatever else went in with us at this one, we were the only part of the university that got a prediction spot on, and everybody else had gone way over. You know, it's a really good idea to be very conservative with these exercises. Otherwise, you put too many people in. And we'll go on to that. And what other? And also, I've got to be clear, highlighted that bit. What happens at REF stays at REF. Okay, there's only a limited amount that I can say today. I can talk about the process, and I can talk about what I think, and I can talk about generally what was said and what people say, but I can't be specific about names, universities, papers, or anything like that. And in any case, I've forgotten all about the papers anyway. But I want to explain to you what happens to the papers in REF, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. And one thing I've got to get across quite clearly at the beginning, and there are still these misconceptions around, is your papers do not go up with a rating next to them, okay, on the web. If you submit a paper to REF, it appears on the web because all the returns have to be there, but the rating of the paper doesn't appear next to your name. So there's no personal risk in this at all. Some people still don't understand this because many people haven't gone in to look at the results. They're all available on the web from 1996 right through to the current REF system. It's worth having a look. You can see the sort of papers that people put in. The actual ratings of papers disappear. So, you know, you're not going to be shamed or even glorified by being put forward in the REF. Just more about me before we get on to REF. I've advised Hong Kong is using exactly the same system. They went down the REE road and are using REF, and I've been advising at Hong Kong Polytechnic University on their REF return. And also in Australia, I've been returned in the ERA at Western Sydney University, and I've been advising them on impact. So that's my sort of pedigree as far as REF goes. And if you get the opportunity to be on a REF Pararari panel, you should take it, because you can dine out for it for a long, long time afterwards, not just in this country, but around the world. So we're coming up to the next REF, REF 20 or REF 2020, is it 20 or 2022? I'm not sure, have we decided yet? 20, it is 20, is it? Yeah, okay.
We don't know yet.
No, but I don't think we do know officially yet. No, I mean, I think it's still to be decided. I mean, it usually ends up being what people think it's going to be, but the actual decision from there was a review by Stern. There's a lot still up in the air yet in terms of the details of REF, so I can't really talk too much about the details of the forthcoming REF, although I'm on the university strategic group. The criteria are not yet fully published. But we reckon we might be aiming towards about 2020 for the next REF. And what I wanted to come back to right at the end of what I want to say is to talking about planning for REF and how you get there and what the process is within a department or a university or what it should be within a university. Some universities are way ahead on this, already having all the papers rated by externals. Some universities haven't started yet. I'm working with universities that have given me 3 lots of papers so far since the last REF to look at, and some universities have yet to send me anything. So people take it at different speeds and at different rates, different ways to process this, but I think it's as well for people in charge of research to think ahead.
It's
a kettle
boiling.
Just in case it goes kaboom. Right. However, I'm pretty clear in my own mind that we also don't actually yet know how many papers people will have to return. There seems to be talk about some flexibility on that. Some doing more, some doing less. Until now, it's been 4 papers per person. And if you didn't have 4 papers, you couldn't really go in without risking a blank, which is a bad thing. But I think it's very unlikely that the particular assessment criteria for articles will change. So it's actually what you're most concerned about as individual academics is that papers you're going to write are going to be put forward within the university for submission to REF or not, as the case may be. So I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And I think we're pretty clear as well that the bar is going up all the time. Only 4-star research will be funded this time around. Last time it was only 3-star research. The time before that it was only 2-star research. This hasn't been said, that's a government decision, but I think it's almost likely. It's almost got to be. Simply because people are getting better at REF. The scores are going up all the time. People are getting much wiser about what to put in, what to select. And I think people are getting much clearer about what is internationally highly rated research according to the REF criteria. So it's likely that the pressure on individual academics will be to get 4-star papers, not necessarily across the board, but you probably would not be submitted unless you had a 4-star, supported by maybe a few 3-star papers. But that again would be a university decision. Depending on what your strategy is, do you want volume, do you want prestige, do you want money, that kind of thing. So these things are all based on sort of local decisions. There are a couple of chairs here. I'll try not
right
to.
In the front.
Right in the front. Yes. Okay. We can be absolutely certain that we will maintain a peer review as the basis of assessment. The system works by peer review. And I'll tell you how that works in REF. So just to give you an idea, last time, and you've probably all seen these tables, we get a set of slides after REF that with facts and figures on them that we're allowed to use. This is the only one of those. The rest of what I'm going to say here will be my thinking about the process. But you know, there were nearly a couple hundred thousand research outputs and 6,975 impact case studies. I can't remember exactly how many panels and how many people were on those panels. But if you divide it up, you've got to do the math in your head. Each assessor on REF, panel members and assessors who do much the same job, had a lot of papers to rate. I think some people had about 1,000 papers to rate. I mean, it's just huge. It's gigantic. You know, I think I had 800 or something like that to rate. Can't actually remember. Everything disappears once you finish REF. All the records, everything disappears. So you can't look back and remind yourself. And you don't want to. It's like revisiting the scene of a car accident, to be honest, because it is incredibly hard work. Anyway, I mean, the ratings aren't as important, but it's just to show you that it's a big volume of work in less than a year. We do this in about really 6 months, you know, from the beginning of the year up to, you know, for about 9 months, and then there's a period of consolidation, doing other things before the results are come out. Okay, so this last time round was how we worked on the sub panels. Again, you may have seen some of this already. This won't change. The red bits are the important bits. Every sub panel runs calibration exercises. In the REE we got together in 5-star hotels, having arrived on first class rail travel to do this. This time around we usually ended up in conference centre somewhere, having got off an economy one. Don't feel too sorry for us, but we had to cut back on what we were getting. But we run calibration exercises where we get samples of papers and samples of impact cases. The impact cases for this, of course, came out a little bit later than the papers. The papers we can do any time because we can pick samples of papers that are already been refed, for example. The impact cases, we do calibration on them too by getting impact cases from other panels that are close to us that we won't actually be rating. So it's quite cleverly worked out. And what we say is that all outputs will be examined in sufficient detail to contribute to the formation of the output sub-profile. So we're not promising that we will read every single paper from beginning to end. We're not promising that we'll read every single paper. We're not saying that we'll read every paper in detail. For any particular output, we're not guaranteeing the way that it'll be handled. What we say is it will be read in sufficient detail for us to come to a decision about its rating. Having said that, all the papers get looked at in some way. Case studies and such like, we're not so concerned about today. And just to be absolutely clear, again, a huge misunderstanding. I still hear people saying, you know, they've got to get published in impact factor journals, they've got to get high cited papers, all the rest of it. We're not allowed to make any use of impact factors whatsoever. It's absolutely forbidden. They never get talked about on the panel. It's made quite clear at the beginning that we judge the research in terms of what's in the paper, and we do not judge the journals. We do have, I think I'll say it later on, but just in case I forget what's on my slide, we do get the access to citation information, but really very little use was made of that. The idea was that at least we could, in marginal cases, use it to make a judgment, but I certainly never made use of it myself, and I'm not very sure that other people did too. The reason being, we're sitting there, it's all electronic, but if it was paper, we'd be sitting there surrounded by papers. We don't have time to go into these things, so we really do try and judge the output as such. And yes, I mean, the only other issue, co-authorship, the reason I've got this slide is not just co-authorship, people say, oh, I haven't got a first author paper, I need to be first author to be in REF. You don't. You just have to be an author. You know, you can't submit. One university could submit this if they had four people on that paper. They could submit that paper four times, provided it went to different units of assessment. But you can't submit the same paper twice to one unit of assessment if two people happen to be co-authors on it in a department, unless you make a very special case. But I'll come to special cases later. There's no letter hindrance in that sense. But sometimes, if there are lots and lots of authors, What's the record for authorship and paper? It's over 1,000, I think, for some paper from CERN or somewhere like that. You have to justify your contribution there, but you don't have to be a first author. Okay, that's the thing. So, you know, you can. One thing is you can actually get people onto papers, provided they've made a contribution. I'm speaking as an editor here. You can get people onto papers if you need to get people into ref. If you've got a handful of you know, 4-star papers and you've got another one coming out, you may want to consider that, but that's up to you. Right, and the judgment we make is on the criteria of originality, significance and rigour. This is what we're supposed to be looking for in the outputs. Each sub-panel has general guidance, then gets together the year before REF and issues its specific guidance by what it means for the different levels of criteria, 5, 4, 3, 2 and 1, and how they're going to judge this for the different kinds of outputs. So, there's kind of self-evident originality, significance and rigour, but they're not easy things to quantify at all. So, and those are the criteria, which you'll probably know. 4, 3, 2 star, unclassified. You've really got to make your best effort not to get unclassified papers. There is a definition of research in REF, and it's quite clear what it is. It includes scholarship, includes systematic reviews, so done properly. It includes, you know, a broad range of science and scholarship, but things like you know, position statements, editorials, workforce development, that sort of thing. You know, I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but things that are not research do not count, and they will just be discounted. So you've really got to try and avoid that, and you've got to realise that. You know, we're looking now at funding only 4-star, not we, sorry, the government will look now at only funding 4-star research. Be aware that international level research starts at 2-star, so the bar is really, really quite high in terms of what REF panels are looking for. I should stop saying we, because there's nothing on earth would make me sit on another REF panel, especially my wife, to whom I've promised I won't. So how it works? Okay. So I think one of the key things is understanding how it works. And every paper is independently peer-reviewed by two people. So, that, you know, and on our panel, that could be two nurses, it could be two dentists, it could be a nurse and a dentist. You know, the papers are divided up, and they're divided up at random. So the assessors do not look at a person's papers, and they do not look necessarily at all of one institution's papers. Also, they'll have a group maybe from an institution, but they will not have all necessarily one person. They may, but the idea is that it's done randomly. So we're not saying, these are 4 papers by Deborah Jackson, so they'll be rubbish or good or whatever. You know, we're trying not to form judgments like that based on, or these papers all come from Oxford Brookes, therefore they're going to be brilliant or whatever. You know, we get a spread of papers. We get a spread of assessors, and we get a spread of disciplines looking at them. Any doubt or any disparity in what the reviewers say will be resolved by arbitration, and ultimately will be resolved by the whole panel if there's a big discussion about a paper. And I can only remember out of the several thousands that we looked at of one paper that came to the whole panel. It's, you know, I sound a little bit like I'm defending myself or the REF here. The REF system works very well in terms of reliability. It's remarkable how close people get the ratings, possibly because we've done calibration exercises, but it's done completely independently. However, the validity can always be questioned. You may want to, well, I don't want to argue about the veracity of REF and how right it is to have it, but the validity can always be questioned. Now, these results are entered separately on the REF system. You can't see the other person's rating until both ratings are in. So there's no collusion on this at all. You know who the other one is, but there's no collusion unless you put your ratings on and they're different, and then you've got to discuss it and you've got to come to an agreement as to where the paper sits. And nominees are discussed and scores agreed. Then the scores are aggregated, and the individual scores are obliterated from the system. So once you've agreed and pressed the, yep, we've agreed that one, there's a lead assessor and a second assessor, that swaps about. Once that's gone, the score goes up, and that's it. You can't go back and change it. You can't even see what you rated. I mean, you know what you agreed, but you don't necessarily see what you rated. Then there's no paper trail maintained. We've got to chuck away every bit. We've got to promise that within the time that would be required, required for a Freedom of Information request. We've got to destroy all paperwork. Strongly discouraged from using any paper trails unless we really have to. And everything's on, you use a laptop or a computer. There's a separate secure email system for people on the assessment panels, and there's a completely separate website with, sign the Official Secrets Act kind of thing before you're given your password for the website to get onto the papers, and under no circumstances to be anybody else to be given access to this at all. So we communicated completely outside the AC.UK network with a separate email system completely. So it was a highly reliable system, I have to say. We hardly ever had big disputes. There were very, very few cases where somebody gave a 5 and somebody gave a 0, but there was one that I remember, so it's possible. But most people, it was 5-4, 3-4, 2-3, most cases. And usually quite easy to resolve. And if you couldn't resolve it, you could get somebody else to have a look and help you out with it. Third person could be just as wrong as two people, of course, but that was the system. There was no guarantee, just because a third pair of eyes doesn't get it. So, as I say, we had, and by the way, once the scores go up for the papers and once the whole exercise is complete, then all you get are the number of 5s, the number of 4s, number of 3s, even those individual scores disappear. So there's no way that you can work back on that system to get back to see what the score on the paper was. Nobody can do that. Completely gone. So there's no way, just to assure you, there's no way that somebody can find out what you got for your paper and hold you to ransom or that. So some people, I mean, up to 1,000 outputs each. We had about 6 months to complete the assessment, from 3 months into it until 9 months, and then a lot of other work to be done after that. I think you've got to ask yourself, how long can an assessor spend on an output? And it's not very long. There's no official figure, and I'm not going to say how long, but it's not very long. You know, we really don't have time to spend a great deal of time, unless we have to look at the paper in detail, unless there's some doubt about it. So I would say that in writing papers for the REF, it's really good to use all the facilities that you can, that a journal offers, for you to showcase what the paper's about. For example, in Deborah's journal, in my journal, we have, well, all journals have got abstracts. You know, make sure the abstract is crystal clear about what the paper's about, in terms of originality, significance and rigour. You know, get the words in there if necessary. Hugh McKenna, who chaired the last RE panel for nursing and the REF sub-panel, said, you get the word international in, you know, just think, you know, don't shoot yourself in the foot, don't play the papers down. Just think how you're going to present it in terms of what the REF wants. So we offer summaries and abstracts, and we offer a summary box where you can actually state these things more or less exactly as it says in REF. What is the significance of this paper? What are the implications? Make sure you use these things. You should do that anyway to get your papers published. And I don't think there's a huge amount of difference between getting published in a good journal and getting a paper that has a good REF score in it. I think they're very congruent, despite the fact that we don't pay any attention to the journals. I think it's just a kind of happy coincidence. So, I think you've got to be careful about what I would call anomalous outputs. Books are always problematic. You can submit almost anything to REF if it comes under the remit of research. And I'm not saying don't write books or don't do any of these things. But I think I would stick to scientific papers that are short and easy to present in terms of what the message is in them. I would tend to avoid books if at all possible. I think in our field they tend not to be research-based. I think leave this to the historians and the philosophers and such like. Books are usually textbooks. Usually people are submitting a book, they may have a chapter in it they think is referable. So I would just say, you know, stick to the mainstream things. Stick to writing good mainstream referable papers. Try not to do things that are within the rules but are difficult and all, you know, make it difficult. So try to avoid, you know, book chapters as well. The problem is that while we don't pay attention to the journals or the sources, book chapters and books tend not to be written in that sort of rigorous fashion that a paper's written in. And they tend not to be peer-reviewed in the same way, so they just tend not to be as good. I think it's very unlikely, unless you wrote the leading book in some field that was research-based and revolutionary, that you'd get a 4-star rated book. and I think it's very unlikely that you get a 4-star or even necessarily a 3-star rated chapter. That's my view, because it's just the way it goes. We're not allowed to take the journals into consideration, but I think that if you do publish an impact factor journals, you will get a better peer review process, you will get a more rigorous peer review process, you will get a better production, and you will get papers with better journals, with better facilities to showcase what you've done. Try to avoid, double counts. Try to avoid, this paper is so big and so important that two of us have to be on it. I mean, you can make cases for that. This is really up to the people who are organising your ref return and putting it in. But I think you've really got to try and avoid, saying, so you and you wrote a paper together and it's really groundbreaking. You both made a substantial contribution to it. So you both want to put it into one return to get credit for it. Usually the message from that is you didn't have another 4-star paper or another 3-star paper, and I'm not saying that's how we judge it, but I think far better to think now how you're going to get another, 2-3-star papers to support a couple of 4-star rather than trying this, and double claims as well. Double claims is two people claiming the same paper. A double count is, I've forgotten what the definition of a double count is now. Maybe I'll have to come back to that, but it's putting something in and asking for it to be considered as two submissions. So maybe a book might be considered as two papers rather than one, that kind of thing. Or you may have a big paper that you think is worth two, but I would really, again, try to avoid that. There's nothing wrong with reports, by the way. One of the best things, I don't know if I'm really helping you to write ref papers here, but one of the best things, that one thing you can put in, which goes down like a, goes down a treat in ref, are really big reports, like health technology assessment reports, Cochrane reports, really big systematic review reports. I mean, they're eminently eligible for ref return, and there's no reason why they can't be 3- and 4-star rated at all. These are very substantial pieces of work. I mean, the significance in those is very high. They're very rigorous because of the process. It's certainly a Cochrane review. We all know how rigorous a Cochrane review is. And the significance and then the originality is usually not in doubt either. So, so don't worry about having, if you've got a big research project and you're thinking, should I divide this up into 3 papers or submit it as a full report, provided you've got other papers to put in, I would always go for the full report on that. But try to avoid local reports, things that have been, done by a local hospital on a survey or something like that, and sticking an ISS, they have to have an ISSN, but anybody can get an ISSN, you just go to your library and get one off the list. I'd really avoid those. They don't tend to be very rigorous pieces of research, to be absolutely honest. So don't, try to avoid, instead of me saying this is what you've got to do, but as I say, try to avoid the things that are seen as being slightly anomalous in ref. So the criteria, basically, originality, significance and rigour. Again, try to, originality is trying to convince the person, don't make a reviewer of a paper. There's a lot of similarity in what I'm saying here in the process of just publishing papers. Don't make reviewers and editors dig for what's original about your paper, but don't make ref panelists dig either. Be absolutely clear. Originality can include replication work. That's very important, but it's an original replicate. It's the first time it's been replicated, or it's so important it needs to be replicated, or we found this as opposed to what they found, significance. More difficult to judge. I think significance is really in the eye of the beholder. Very often, it's quite. You've really got to try and get across why it's significant, but it's quite difficult sometimes, especially for people like myself, say reading a dentistry paper or a dentist reading a nursing paper or whatever. It did happen, but you've really got to try and make the case and make it clear. And then the rigor, and there are ways of making sure that certain kinds of papers are rigorous. In our field, we do a lot of systematic reviews, randomised controlled trials. I would say that we really would expect to see randomised controlled trials that follow the CONSORT guidance. systematic reviews that follow the Prisma guide. Those are easy shots because you can look at the paper, you can see if the Prisma flowchart or the concept flowchart's there or the checklist's been done and whatever. You know, so there are easy ways. You know, if you've done a sort of a review that isn't systematic and it's just one of these discursive kind of reviews, by systematic I don't mean a meta-analysis necessarily, but just these sort of review papers that we used to write years ago, don't bother with it at all. It doesn't follow a standard process. It just, I can guarantee it won't be highly rated. It may count as research, but it won't get a high rating. So make sure that all the things that are internationally accepted as indicating rigour are in your paper. And there's an awful lot more of them now than there were last year and the year before that. And it just keeps growing. Go on the Equator website and make sure that if you're doing a qualitative paper, it's following some of the guidance for qualitative papers. If it's a case control study, make sure it's following those procedures. Those are easy ways to demonstrate rigour. But again, it's exactly the same for trying to get a paper published. And I don't think there's too much difference between the two, because I think you've got to get published to get into refs. I think you've got to pay attention to these things anyway. So ref is not a tick box exercise. So we're not going through and saying, you know, 3 points for rigour and two for, you know, it doesn't work like that. You know, I think we all have an idea in our head about what these things are. Difficult to explain, but we don't necessarily say it's got to show this amount of that, this amount of that, and this amount of that. The phrase that's always used in the guidance, on the panel, has been used for years. In the round, the paper has got to sort of, you know, meet these sort of criteria. So we don't have a set of boxes to tick to make sure that they're all addressed or addressed to the right level. We have to make a judgment. And it's not a peer review of the article, so we really are encouraged not to re-review the article. We're not sitting there reading it like a peer reviewer of a journal who's essentially looking for every possible mistake. You know, we don't have time for that. We just don't have time to do that. We're looking at the paper from the point of view of what the headlines are in terms of originality, significance and rigour. So again, just to emphasise, one of the most important things you can do is to make sure that these things are crystal clear. Abstract, summary, box, conclusion to the article, get them in there. All the bits that everyone reads and tends to miss out the middle bits. You want to avoid, when you're having a paper reviewed, and you want to avoid in ref, as somebody digging too far into it, to be honest. So it's a peer assessment of the research, not of the paper as such. So, citations and journal rankings, mentioned it a little bit already. Citation data are made available to us, and the citation data that are made available to us come from Scopus, and they're given over the period of from when the papers are being considered, so that would be from the last ref up into the current ref, and there are normed levels of citation for every discipline, and there are normed sort of levels of citation that you might expect based on overall citations at different stages. So you wouldn't expect a paper that was published 6 months ago, just submitted just before ref, to have a huge number of citations. But you'd kind of expect that maybe to have built up some citations if it was published 5 or 6 years ago. So we see these patterns, but as I say, it isn't the most important thing. I wouldn't go around looking to get your most highly cited papers in necessarily. If you've got a paper that you're sure is really 4-star and one that you think is 3-star, yet it's been highly cited, I would put the one in that you're sure is 4-star, not the other one, because it, you know, the use that was made of citation data was very, very little indeed. And it was usually just a case of giving a rating to a paper and then looking, that's interesting, it's been cited a lot. You heard that kind of comment, that people weren't saying, well, this has been cited a million times, therefore, you know, it's So whether citation data will come out in the next ref, whether we'll be told exactly how it's going to be used, or whether it will be dropped, we don't know yet. I think the general consensus of looking back on the citation data is and this is not the ref panel view, this is the subsequent views, it was pretty much a waste of time. And there's no ideal system for reporting citations. There's no ideal way of comparing disciplines, and really it's very, very difficult. So they'll be available possibly, but I wouldn't drive your ref return on the basis of that. Journal rankings, sorry, I have said this already, but they assiduously never enter the discussion. Again, I'm not giving anything away here to say that Ref panels are run by a chair, who's an academic, supported by two administrators, who are usually very senior university administrators, seconded out for sometimes 18 months, maybe even 2 years, because it's a huge job. They work across several panels, and they're there, and they know the regulations inside out and back to front, which I assure you very few people sitting around the table at a ref meeting do, because there's a lot of them and they're quite complicated as well. They know everything, and they will stymie any discussion that goes down this road at all. So I'm just giving you the absolute guarantee that if it says this time around, as I'm sure it will do, because in the UK we just don't go for these kind of things, that journal rankings are not part of the exercise. They really are not part of the exercise. So again, I wouldn't be driven by that. So writing a referable paper, using the words originality, significance, rigor, get them in there. Said this already. Use the words international and global. Yeah, you can't pull the wool, but I do think what I'm saying is that it really has got international or global significance. You should be emphasising that there. Don't use the words gratuitously, but I think it's always wise to play up these things. The sort of questions that people say when they're discussing with each other, especially with their anomalies with paper, and you try to talk up a paper or get somebody else to talk up a paper, is why? Why do you think this is such a significant paper? Why do you think it's so important? So people are asking questions when they come to discussing the papers. If the paper's got the same score, that's it finished, but if people have got a dispute, it's always good if you're trying to play it up to be able to point to something. I think good journals will help you to write good papers. I mean, I think that's the other thing. That's the only reason for taking impact factor into account, is I think the impact factor journals are the best. Whether you believe in impact factor or not, and relative levels of impact factor, that's arguable. But I think that the good impact factor journals, wherever they lie on that table, will help you to write the best papers, because they're the ones with international editorial boards. You've got proper peer review processes, that kind of thing. I would certainly try to avoid using any predatory journals. This is there's not an official Hefke position on this, but I would avoid using them simply because they tend not to be very good journals. That's the problem with them. And the last ref took place in 2014, where there were something like 100 so-called predatory journals, as identified by Geoffrey Beale. May his list rest in peace now, because it's gone. There are over 1,000 now. They're just everywhere, and you'll know from getting emails every day, "My esteemed professor, greetings of the day, how is your health? We would like to invite you to, submit in this journal," whatever. I would avoid them simply because they tend not to be good journals. I think it would create a very bad impression. And you never know. Universities and Hefke, I'm sure, are very reluctant to say that's predatory and that's not. But I mean, we all kind of know, and you never know, they may come up with a position on what are so-called predatory journals. But anyway, I've said enough. What I'm saying is, the quality of the journal will help you to write better papers. And we did get the occasional, what you'd call, dodgy journal paper coming in ref. I remember seeing a few myself. Can't remember where they're from, and I wouldn't say anyway. But I mean, they are just, they were just what they were. They were obviously papers that couldn't get published anywhere else, and somebody was desperate and put it in there, and they just weren't very good. But again, that's not an official position. That was an experience in my view on predatory journals. And remember, again, I'm probably teaching to suck eggs here. This is not so much about writing papers, but about the process. Remember the stipulation about open access. I'm assuming Oxford Brookes has got a good system going. You have to have it now, but it's up to individuals when you get a paper published. It starts with you when you get a paper published, accepted, to remember to get it onto your repository straight away, get the final accepted manuscript there. Even if the journal doesn't allow you to put that final accepted manuscript up there at all at any time, you have to go through that process, and the university has then to make a case to say, well, this journal doesn't allow this, but the manuscript was available and it was registered open access as soon as within 3 months of acceptance. But so do try, because if you don't do it within 3 months, You know, if the acceptance date on the journal says 1st of July and you didn't put it until the 31st of December, that paper will not be eligible to be returned and ref. So the HEFCE have really tightened up on this. So there's a whole load of other things around the process, not just writing the paper. So you've got to make sure you do the right thing with it and have processes in place to do that. The problem is that people tend to submit papers and maybe not tell people about them, and then they get them published and then they forget about them. So just please, you know, don't shoot yourself in the foot by foot. Oh yeah, but open access, sorry, doesn't mean, yeah, say green room, it doesn't mean you have to pay for open access. Don't worry about no. That was the big, you know, everybody, whoa, when this first came out, we nearly, heads nearly exploded in our university because we don't have much money for open access. But they said, no, green route is okay. So green route means the final accepted manuscript. That goes beyond the panel, we just give the information. Right, again, I'm talking more about process here than actually writing papers, because it is very difficult to answer that specific question. And with your PVC for research here, I'm sure I'm, again, saying things which are very familiar, but the processes leading up to REF, I mean, basically, it is to do with processes, okay? You've got to institute some method of internal peer review. Now, I don't know, when I'm looking at Deborah, I don't know if this is the unit, if you're judging everybody here, or people here maybe go to different units of assessment, that's completely up to you. For example, in Hull, we're on a faculty, we're doing it on a faculty basis, but our faculty has got medicine, nursing, some allied health professions, biomedical sciences, psychology, all the different panels, but we all have a look at most of what comes out from every one of those, you know, subjects within our faculty, but that's just the way it's organised. But you've got to institute some sort of internal peer review mechanism to make judgments on the papers. And whether you look at everybody's outputs, and I said again, I think all outputs, as your Provost Chancellor said, all outputs of whatever calibre should go up on your repository, that's for sure, that's good practice anyway now. Or whether you select your own four best papers, or whether you get some help to do it, but I think there's got to be some stage amongst yourselves with that you start to judge, you know, whether your papers are 1, 2, 3, or 4 star. And then there's got to be some other check on that within the institution or perhaps within an organisational unit that says, yeah, we think these are the best. For people who have not been through this exercise before, if somebody in your university says, ah, that's a 3-star paper, that's a 4-star, they don't know, okay? They think it is, okay? Yeah. But you do need to come to some decision. It's not a free-for-all. And I think you've also got to realise, as individuals, not to take it personally if you are not returned. It's there are equal opportunities statements will come out around the time, and, you know, to ensure that people are not disadvantaged. So you must have an internal REF review, and I think that you need to have, you know, you need an external process. I'm not touting for work here, by the way, because I'm not happy to do it, but I've got to doing a few. But there are plenty of former sub-panel members around who are happy to do this work, and I don't know of anybody who says, oh, I don't want to do that. And I think it is really worth getting ex-panel members to look at papers. The going rate's about £30 a paper or something like that. But you know, but as I say, there are plenty, and maybe some universities may want to have two different panel members looking at them. And you know, it's great if you can get somebody in each subject or discipline. But you know, closely cognate subjects are probably good enough. But I think I'm sure the university will have a system whereby it goes out to external reviewers at some point. And your selection, of course, whether you go in, whether your papers go in, will depend on the university strategy. And again, it will depend on what the REF criteria are, 4, 2, 6, or as many papers as you want, or a number of papers per group or whatever. It'll all depend on that. So the timing for 2022, okay? If it's 2020, we're already in trouble. Some people are already in trouble, okay? But I mean, the thing is, for 2022, the papers have got to be published with a digital, forget that this doesn't shine on that screen. They've got to be published with a digital object identifier by the 31st of December 2001. That can mean a PDF. It doesn't have to be in the journal by that stage. It can be now published as a Deborah's journal, my journal, put up final accepted manuscripts now. We put them up. So as long as it's got a DOI, you're fine. You're in. If it's not up by 31st of December, you can't be in. The actual census date will be before then, but the publications have to be available by that date. So looking at that, you've really got to realise, I'm sure you know this already, but I think it's always worth, from the point of view of strategy, having a look over this again. It can take up to 12 months easily, can't it? And longer in some journals to get published. In the case of one of my papers, never so far in 3 years, but never mind. The editors just haven't quite grasped the brilliance of the paper yet. I'm convinced. So writing can take 12 months. Including, you know, getting a paper, getting it rejected. So you're already 2 years behind that deadline, you know. So 22 becomes, you know, it's not like Christmas shopping where you can leave it to the last minute. You've really got to be thinking a year ahead in each stage, and it actually becomes a little bit frightening when you actually work it down to the bone. You know, ideally people should have had 4 referable papers ready in the last ref period, ready for, you know, to be submitted now, but we don't all work like that. 2021 becomes 2020, the final acceptance period. Final submission period comes back to, you know, 2019, and that, you know, final writing period starts next year, you know, so that starts next year, you know. So really, you know, what I'm saying is, you know, if you want to be sure of getting through all the processes that you might have to go through to finally get a paper that's suitable for ref, you know, a good paper that's suitable for ref, you know, you can't begin soon enough, to be honest. It's very risky leaving it to the last minute, and the best papers are not written at the last minute. The best papers are given enough time to be written, to sit there for a while on your computer while you have a think about it, edit it a few times, give it to the person next door to have a look at. You know, you don't be shy in these processes. Get plenty of peer review along the way, colleagues, and then your director or whatever having a look at it. You've got to leave time for these things. The worst papers are the ones that are scooted out at the last minute, may never be accepted, and even if they are, you may think, damn, that could have been better for ref. And I've got a perfect example of a paper that could have been better for ref from my own department, which was a systematic review done according to all the right criteria, but didn't mention the PRISMA criteria, didn't have a PRISMA flowchart. It was done according to that, but the person didn't put it in, they just rushed it off, you know. And when I saw the title of the paper, this is a dead ringer for a ref, and looked at the paper, that's never going to fly, you know. So, and that was just through rushing, so you've really got to plan ahead. I'm sure you know that already. Okay, if you want to send me any abuse, that's my email, or if you want me to send you some back, that's my Twitter site. I don't know if Orchid's going to play any part in REF, but I think, just as an aside and as a journal editor, I'd really encourage anybody who doesn't have an Orchid number to get one. It's a really good way to keep a track of what you're doing and for other people to look. It's nothing to do with REF necessarily, but it's excellent to get a nice little QR code that people can scan and find you. But it's becoming the gold standard for having a sort of web page about your research and your papers. And if you change your name or your gender or whatever, you know, change your mind, then your number doesn't change, it stays the same, you know. So it's a very, very good system. And I think it won't be long before journals, we offer the facility, but I think it will soon become compulsory. So it could be important for REF in the future. And I think research grants almost expect you to give your Orchid number so they can check up on the veracity, because it's an absolutely verifiable record of your research grants and your publications. You can see what you like about yourself in the little profile at the beginning, but that's the only chance you get. So I think it's important as well. That's an hour. Talked long enough. Happy to discuss any more. I'll shut up now.
Thanks so much, Roger.